welcome to another Radio Who What Why podcast. In San Francisco, I'm Peter B. Collins, one of America's leftiest cities. Has been the scene of right-wing protests, and it has led city leaders to use surveillance systems, sometimes borrowed from the Joint Terrorism Task Force and other agencies that were set up to address international terrorism, not First Amendment activism. Tracy Rosenberg is the executive director of Media Alliance. They are a media reform and advocacy group based here in the San Francisco area. And she's also a co-founder of Oakland Privacy. Tracy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Peter. Happy to be here.
Tell us, how long have you been concerned about expansive surveillance in the East Bay of the San Francisco area?
Well, a pretty long time. I mean, of course, like everyone else, I was blown away by the 2013 Snowden revelations. I think for a long time, as a sort of organization concerned with digital platforms and the internet, we were seeing how the original promise of the internet, that everyone would be connected to everyone and have access to everything, was really being sort of turned around on us, so mm-hmm. that what was supposed to be something that people could use to reach out was becoming a tool for them to be watched.
Certainly.
In the East Bay, of course, in 2012, we became aware of plans in Oakland for a citywide surveillance gauntlet funded by the Department of Homeland Security and Oakland Privacy, the anti-surveillance coalition that I co-founded, took an active role in stopping that.
And they had plans for a master control room that essentially would surveil every block of the city of Oakland. And Oakland has its issues, but the idea that setting up a massive surveillance system is going to address them seems pretty far-fetched. Now, more recently, in 2018, last year, there was a planned rally in Berkeley called No to Marxism. So we yeah. have right-wing activists come for their First Amendment expression, and there was concern based on past skirmishes at the UC Berkeley campus and on the streets of Berkeley that there would be a response from Antifa. And so what did the Berkeley Police Department, and Berkeley is the city I referred to as the leftiest town in America, what did
right.
they do, Tracy Rosenberg?
Well, as it turned out, I mean, yes, there had been a substantial amount of what we could politely call street brawling that had happened in 2017. Basically, right-wing groups put out a call for folks to come to Berkeley, the most progressive blue city in the U.S., and, you know, speak out for white supremacy and race hatred. And the city of Berkeley responded. People came out. They organized themselves in anti-fascist groups, and they basically said, no, not here, not in our town. And there was some fighting. In 2018, one of the folks who had been involved with this, I think her name is Amber something, said, let's do it again. And she called her rally Say No to Marxism. And, of course, local anti-fascist groups organized and said, no, we don't want you here, not in Berkeley. The administration of Berkeley, while saying all of the right things about First Amendment protections and sort of setting up United Against Hate signs all over town and basically supporting the idea that we don't want these kinds of activities here, but everyone has a right to express themselves behind closed doors, went to the Department of Homeland Security. We have a fusion center here in the Bay Area. It's called CNICRIC, Northern California Regional Intelligence Center, and secretly set up high-tech cameras with appearance detection and motion search capabilities and set them up secretly all over town.
And these systems, which are borrowed or can be borrowed by local law enforcement agencies from these so-called fusion centers, and there are more than 70 of them that have been set up across the country to coordinate law enforcement activities. And I refer to it as vertical integration, where the command and control of the federal government is informed by the local collection of information, much of it legitimate, some of it not, by the foot soldiers of local police departments. And the collaboration between the fusion centers and local police occurs out of the sight of the public. And when the Berkeley Police Department borrowed this facial recognition camera system and installed it in public spaces in Berkeley, did they notify the public, Tracy?
Absolutely not. There was not a word. When we're talking about fusion centers, we're talking about a national network that was set up after the events of 9/11. And they were largely set up to what we would call sort of gather information from a variety of sources, both public and private, and fuse it together with the idea of sort of doing sophisticated relational mapping and what we often call guilt by association or relation, basically to take your targets and look at all of their connections and associations and liaisons and try to basically set up webs. This is very much what, for example, the technology company Palantir says that they do with their software. Mm-hmm. That it is essentially super sophisticated relational and kind of associational mapping.
Understood.
And the fusion centers were basically set up to be sort of physical manifestations of that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of Berkeley, the interesting thing was not only did they not tell anyone, but they actually had a law on the books, which we advocated for, a surveillance transparency ordinance that specifically required them to get city council consent before they took actions like this and have some kind of public hearing where they put out what they were planning to do. And the city council affirmatively said, yes, we will let this happen in Berkeley. Never happened.
So from the accounts that I've received, and tell me if I have this correctly, following the deployment of these devices, which are the brand name is Avigilon, the city of Berkeley then moved to continue to use cameras after there had been some shootings in San Pablo Park in August of 2018. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's actually how we found out. The cameras, Avigilon is the company, and they are Motorola products, and you can look them up and see that they have pretty advanced analytical capabilities. NCRIC, as we know, also has an extensive facial recognition service that it offers to local law enforcement agencies. So what happened in terms of sort of the chain of information is that Berkeley unfortunately had some shootings that appeared to be gang-related in September and October of 2018 in a sort of recreational area called San Pablo Park. It had some tennis courts and some soccer fields and some baseball fields, and so lots of kids and lots of families. And the shootings were scary. They happened in broad daylight, late afternoon. There were bullets flying. And so the city, of course, said we have to do something. And what they felt would address the situation was to put in security cameras. That's not emblematic, but the question becomes what sort of cameras, with what sort of capacities, what are you doing with the data, who has access to it? They sort of short-circuited a lot of those questions. So after the fact, we started saying, okay, what kind of cameras did you put in and what sort of capacities do they have and where's the data? And in so doing, we did what they call a public records request. They sent us a whole bunch of stuff. And one of those things referred to the Homeland Security Fusion Center having access to the cameras. They had a login for the cameras. And we said, how is this even possible? Then they said, not those cameras in San Pablo Park, the cameras that we used in August for the free speech protests. And then we said, what? So that's how we found out.
So, Tracy, let me pause for a moment just to observe that we, just in this initial description, see a very significant and troubling mission creep, because we were told that these entities, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the fusion centers, this renewed collaboration with police departments up and down the ladder, that all of this is only focused to protect us from foreign terrorists. And yet we see it routinely deployed against First Amendment activists. And a little bit later, we'll talk about what's going on in the state of Oregon related to protests over the Coos Bay LNG proposed facility. But we see, you know, a circumstance where you might be sympathetic to city officials because of the skirmishes between right wingers and Antifa that it preceded. And so, you know, people tend to accept that. And then we see this normalized, and these devices are used for ordinary criminal activity. And I'm not rationalizing gang activity or diminishing the impact on victims of criminal behavior. But these technologies and these legal authorities were set up only to focus on international terrorism. And we are seeing it focused at the local level on free speech activities. This is deeply troubling.
Yes, in every sense. The war comes home, which is the expression. But the fundamental problem here is, what is the definition of terrorism? We think that we know what it means, but we see over and over again that it's sort of the ever-expanding word. And we've seen this when we've sort of, you know, pushed these agencies on what do you mean by terrorism, and they've brought up terms like black identity extremist. We don't know what that means. Well, we do know what it means. It means Black Lives Matter activists. But how is that terrorism? And then we take a look at this Berkeley, and we see Antifa folks who really are just community members who are standing up to what they see as fascist creep and sort of a normalization of hate language and white supremacy language that they think is dangerous, and rightfully so. Is that terrorism? And when you talk about sort of the history of social change in the U.S., things like nonviolent civil disobedience, I mean, we have Mario Savio in Berkeley saying, throw your body against the gears of the machine to make injustice stop. And these kinds of activities become basically inflated or defined as terrorism. And then you have an international intelligence mechanism that is essentially turned against nonviolent social change activities in the U.S. And this is an existential threat to any kind of social change or social progress.
And Tracy, this just strikes me as completely antithetical to the zeitgeist of Berkeley. You know, the city has a young, nominally progressive mayor, Jesse Araguin, and progressive council members. There are ordinances that prohibit this kind of surveillance practice. And they even went so far as to exempt the police department from certain facial recognition limitations that they passed in a recent ordinance. So the contradictions...
Well, they actually haven't done that yet, but they are scheduled to do so on October 15th.
I see. Okay.
And so the question here is sort of, you're unanimously voting for these things and you're saying all of the right things, but behind our backs, you're doing things that are entirely different.
So is there a disconnect between the elected leadership of Berkeley and its police department?
That certainly seems to be the case. And it's probably a more profound disconnect than that. What we often find is that elected officials, no matter how progressive, are very easily sort of shepherded by law enforcement and by the forces behind law enforcement, which include our federal government and sort of the intelligence and infrastructure and the stuff coming down from national, to basically turn on their head everything that they say in public. So because our surveillance ordinance passed unanimously, it wasn't a contested vote, it wasn't a, you know, a 5-4 squeaker kind of thing, it passed unanimously. The city was 100% committed in public to making sure that transparency and consent were the basis for any surveillance activity by their police department, which is, you know, right and appropriate for a progressive city. And then what turned out is that what they said and what they voted for on the surface was extremely different to what they did when they felt that they were under pressure, when they felt that there were protests in the city that were getting out of hand, when they felt that there was gang activity that they were frightened by. They basically took all those words and threw them out with the garbage. And, you know, this was not just words. It was municipal law. So we really are seeing, and I don't want to, you know, go too far here, but we are seeing sort of lawless government in action. We are sort of seeing the surveillance state sort of overpower the actual law. You know, they are taking those kinds of steps to say, when things happen, when crimes are committed, when there are problems, we don't have to follow the law, and we're not going to.
Tracy, in the discovery by Oakland Privacy under the public records laws, did you find any other activities that raised eyebrows? For example, has Berkeley borrowed Stingray technology from the JTTF or the Northern California Fusion Center, to your knowledge?
Right. At this point in time, I have to answer these kinds of questions sort of not yet. In other words, we haven't found out about it yet, because I kind of feel like anything's possible at this point, because we were genuinely shocked by the Nickerk.
Mm-hmm. All right. And one of the other areas that has concerned me that surfaced recently, and I don't know if this drew your attention, but in the trial of the Proud Boys street fight in New York City, mm-hmm. the district attorney used a reverse search warrant, and it was served on Google. And Google was forced to divulge to the district attorney the location of cell phones in a certain designated mm-hmm. area, and right. also to report on any activity from phones or other devices in a certain geographical zone. So this created a technology dragnet, a fence, if you will, around a certain geographical area, and all of the people inside that zone were treated as suspects. When, you know, there were 8 or 10 of the Proud Boys, and there were somewhere around a dozen of the Antifa people who took them on. And the claim was that they were trying to identify the Antifa people because they were the victims of the Proud Boys, and they wanted them to testify at this trial. And I just found this astounding that they could argue that despite the clear language of the Fourth Amendment requiring probable cause and specificity, mm-hmm. that they were forcing Google to cough up information under this bizarre reverse search warrant.
Yes. I mean, to be 100% clear, this is sort of the guilty until proven innocent theory yeah. of law.
Mm-hmm.
Enforcement that basically says if you're in the proximity and something happened, we can sweep you up. And that is fundamentally constitutionally unsound. And we have it perpetuating through law enforcement on a broad basis. What happened in New York, geolocation data is, of course, extremely sensitive because it's literally physically where you are. And the basic premise of collecting it really has to be probable cause. It has to be significant reasons to believe that you personally have committed some act of wrongdoing. And once we step away from that, guilty until proven innocent is not a fact anymore for any of us.
And Tracy, to your knowledge, have you seen any other deployment of a reverse search warrant since the New York incident?
Yes, there have been several all over the country. The warrants are difficult to uncover. They have had to go to court to get them, but the courts have been liberal in distributing them. And they have been not only for First Amendment type activities like these sort of, you know, Proud Boy brawls, but also for traditional street crime. There was one that involved a bank robbery in the Midwest. And again, it picked up the information for anyone who was outside of a bank in a downtown area over an hour-long period of time, which is an extraordinary assortment of people who were sort of swept into this investigation with no consent or, you know, agreement to participate on their own part. They were not asked. And I want to make it clear that while Google is under pressure and the courts have been helping them, they are not required to do this. They are making a choice not to fight these kinds of court orders when they get them, or not to fight them hard enough.
Well, and the tech companies turn these government requests for information into a revenue center. They charge the government to cough up our personal data.
Yep. I mean, basically, you can fight or you can turn it into a capitalist opportunity.
Tracy, I want to get your comment on what's going on in Oregon as well. They have a fusion center called Titan Fusion Center, and it collaborates with the Southwest Oregon Joint Task Force. Similar structure as we've described here in the Bay Area. And I'm familiar with the situation in Coos Bay, Oregon, because for many years I hosted a syndicated radio show with an affiliate, KBBR, in Coos Bay. So I am familiar with the long-running efforts to install an offshore platform to load liquefied natural gas, LNG, onto ships for export. And environmentalists have protested this and fought it for years. And now with the Trump administration bulldozing the efforts to block the Keystone XL pipeline and related issues, there is renewed interest on the part of the industry to build this Jordan Cove energy project. And before any serious protests have begun, these elements of our law enforcement system have begun monitoring potential protest groups and tracking their activities, harvesting social media messages and emails. And all of this is integrated, similar to what we described, with the upper reaches of the federal law enforcement system. And we also see in Coos Bay where the police are actively collaborating with the private security company that is hired by the project's owner, which is a company called Pembina. So we've seen this happen before, where the elements of law enforcement were used to monitor and impact the protest activities of Occupy activists back during the Obama administration. And particularly in Phoenix, I saw evidence of the way the government agencies were directly communicating with the private security offices of banks in ways that are really problematic.
Yes, eco-terrorism is another one of those categories that has been made up by the intelligence infrastructure to sort of conflate First Amendment type activities and social protest movements with terrorism. There's no actual connection. What we're seeing is sort of what we saw back in the 60s and 70s, where the CIA and, you know, even going back a bit, J. Edgar Hoover, and all of that was basically turned on the domestic social change movements of the day. Instead of doing what the CIA is supposed to do, which is pay attention to foreign countries and American interests overseas, on. The federal government largely didn't do much about it, although they eventually issued a church committee and sort of said after the fact, this was bad and we shouldn't do this, but we're doing it once again. And in this sort of iteration, what you could sort of call COINTELPRO 2.0, which I think is perfectly valid, or maybe 3.0, at this point, we have a significant amount of cooperation and facilitation from the private sector, where the powers of the tech companies have largely been put at the disposal of the COINTELPRO type operations.
Yes, and this is coupled with much looser standards, because the trigger point for being under surveillance as a First Amendment activist should be much higher than what's being used. But they don't even approach probable cause. They use what are called suspicious activity reports. And often they simply make up a potential for violence that has not been exhibited in any way that can be objectively observed.
No. The standard, of course, should be violence. And when we call violence blocking a freeway or blocking a pipeline truck, then we really have kind of jumped the shark in terms of what violence actually is. These are things that inconvenience business, and potentially they inconvenience you if you're trying to get home from work and the freeway is blocked. But they are not violent activities which cost you life and limb. So that's a real confusion of kind of language. One of the Fusion Center's sort of remarkable characteristics is that one of the activities that they took on was basically what we in grade school call tattletaling, with these suspicious activity reports, which were basically set up as opportunities for businesses, individuals, law enforcement, really anyone to file a report saying, I saw something and it's suspicious. It's sort of the parallel of those alerts that you hear in airports. You know, if you see a bag and it's unattended, kind of say something.
Right.
And for years, people would, you know, put their luggage down and turn around and an alarm would go off. But basically, suspicious activity reports, and there was an audit done. The last one that I read was in 2014 that go out to the Fusion Centers, had basically been an agglomeration of people basically reporting all kinds of strange things and our taxpayer money being used to investigate all of this, largely to not much effect. For example, there was one I was taking a look at the 2014 Fusion Center report that went to the Senate that involved like some guys who were fishing off the coast of Florida. And the reason that their behavior was suspicious was because they were fishing in a place that was known not to have too much fish. No, seriously.
That's suspicious.
And like our taxpayer dollars were used to investigate these two guys. And as it turned out, the results of the lengthy investigation were that they were bad fishermen. They were fishing in a bad place.
And they failed to buy a fish finder.
Yeah, but this is insane. And, and the Senate kind of said something like, look, we didn't set up 73 fusion centers to investigate this kind of garbage. But the whole SARS basis is, you know, spy on your neighbors and report them. And we sort of see this now technology kind of jumping on this with Ring and the automated doorbells next door and basically setting up a culture where we are all spying on each other and turning each other in. Or who knows what.
Well, Tracy, I want to thank you for your vigilance, fighting for the Bill of Rights and our freedoms in this country. Does Oakland Privacy have a website or any other public contact that people might want to look into?
Yes, we do. We're at www.oaklandprivacy.org. We do encourage people to check out the website. You can contact us directly at contact@oaklandprivacy.org. And for folks in Berkeley, we're going to be doing a little press conference event in front of the next Berkeley City Council meeting on October 15th at 1231 Addison Street, which is the BUSD Auditorium, which is where the City Council meeting will be held. And we encourage people to join us there to basically say, Berkeley, what the hell?
Tracy Rosenberg, Thanks again for your vigilance, and thanks for talking with us today. Thanks for listening to this Radio Who What Why podcast with Tracy Rosenberg. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com. And I'd appreciate any contribution you can make to support the investigative journalism work here at Who What Why.